You're listening to an Iconic exclusive, which is an interview that we do with one of the industry designers or participators with 13th Age. Due to the nature of the interview, this podcast may run a little bit longer than our normal episodes, as we're just going to let the person we're interviewing talk and answer our questions, and we're going to have a good time doing it. So just be warned, this one may run longer than what you're normally used to listening to.
This is Iconic, with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick. Iconic exclusive.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hello.
Hey.
Today we have a special interview, 13th Age's very own Rob Hainso and Jonathan Tweet. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hi there.
Congratulations on the Ennie nominations.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it's good. It makes me realize that when we won it last year, I got up on stage and claimed I need to write a blog post thanking everybody, you know, and I didn't do it yet. Yes, so the new Ennie nominations are fun. Bestiary is on the plate. Of course, it has excellent competition.
Oh yeah,
yeah. The I see it's up against the 5th edition Monster Manual for Best Monster Adversary. What would you say to listeners who may have not had a chance to look at them? What are the differences?
So what I like about the Bestiary is that it really shows how 13th Age gets more mileage out of classic monsters.
Instead, I think one big difference is that the 5th edition Bestiary is a big book with as many monsters as possible, and it has story details, but it's kind of telling you, hey, this is the story. And the 13th Age is a game in which the players and the GM are co-creating campaigns, and different campaigns can be different. And so one of the things we really tried to go ahead and do with our Bestiary was to give people multiple options and to not fill in all the details, but instead to tell part of an interesting hook, and then so that people could actually be really happy, finishing the rest of it off themselves. And that applies to the mechanics, where you've got really interesting, new mechanics for stuff that people wouldn't have had before, everything from orc diseases to frost terrain environments to just the way the monsters intersect with the world and ideas for how they intersect with the icons in different styles of campaigns. I think in a certain sense, if you're comparing the two, I'm sure that ours is a little bit crazier.
Yeah.
Yes.
And possibly a little more fertile for ideas. Simultaneously, our approach to, I think I'll just go ahead and say one giant difference for me. I want to create monsters that are interesting at the table, and the only problem that I have with the 5th edition Bestiary Monster Manual, it's just kind of boring in terms of play. It's like, oh, this monster grabs, and it's like, blah? That's the kind of design we try not to do, and so... Now, I'm not sure that's a fair assessment because I haven't read the whole thing. But the pieces of it I do read, I always just sort of bounce off the monster stats.
I'll say having run a 13th Age and a concurrent 5th edition game for about the last year, I am bored running 5th edition monsters. They do have some neat legendary, they have some neat mechanics, but design-wise, I have more fun as the GM.
Yeah, no. See, I think what you're saying is something important. I think it's very possible that for the most of the people at the table, it matters less that the monsters in 5th edition are boring. The players don't entirely care because the players are focused on their own thing. You don't as a player, but for the GM, yes, it makes a huge. It's really different. So yeah, I'm glad. Thank you for saying that because certainly that's what I came away when I tried to do it. I was just like, whoa, bored now.
Yeah,
need to add other things somehow. So yep.
Yeah, I had both of them opened up earlier this week, just comparing them side by side, and a couple of things that I noticed was one, the 13th Age bestiary is just chock full of story hooks. I felt like the 5th edition, it had a lot more monsters in it, but it was mostly just stat blocks and some flavor text here or there. But for instance, like the kobolds in the D&D book, there's only one page on them. And there's seven pages on kobolds in 13th Age bestiary. So it's fodder for the GMs to take and use and figure out how they want to, you know, take those monsters and introduce them in their campaign. And I really like that.
Yeah. So I would say, rather than comparing the two, because I'm really not positive that I can make fair comparisons, mm-hmm. I will say that we try to not waste any space in 13th Age books. When Jonathan and I, when we're working on projects, we're trying to make it that every page is really worth your while. And that means that it has to sort of be able to inspire many different things. And I think that attitude, you know, that was really what we tried to do in the bestiary, so that when you get seven pages of kobolds, you can use them many different ways in many different campaigns. It's kind of like trying to make the pieces of the game good for thinking as well as good for playing, so that, you know, either you're going to think about it or you're going to have play value, and the two should sort of loop and spiral together. I think we had different design goals in terms of the two books.
I feel like the Monster Manual, worked on in third edition, you know, the question was sort of, well, how many hit points should a kobold have, and how much damage should a kobold do? And if we answered those questions, it seemed like, well, okay, we've defined the kobold. Mm-hmm. But for 13th Age, our question is, why would anyone want to put this monster on the table? What's fun about this monster that you're not going to get with some other monster? And, like, how the hit points and the damage are the least interesting problem to solve. The real problem to solve is, what's going to make JM interested in running this monster after he's been running monsters for a year?
Oh, it's or totally the kobold trap table.
Or 30 years.
Yeah.
30 years, yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I stopped running a Pathfinder game. I just got bored, and I'm one that runs everything, so I was like, I'm bored. These guys, yeah, they're fun, killing, looting, but it's like, eh. And I see what you did with the bestiary, just looking back at 13 True Ways with the devils and how they change just depending on the icon you want to go with.
Yeah.
It's fabulous as GM. Just gives you the ideas, just keep rolling. You're like, oh, I can do this and change them, and it's fun. And you should have more pages of kobolds. Kobolds kick butt.
Yeah. Oh, well, then here's your insider information. In a upcoming installment of the 13th Age Monthly, written by me and Jonathan, called Rakshasas and Reavers, there will be at least a page or more of kobolds.
Woot! Excellent.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, kobolds are great.
Have you, just on a complete side note, have either of you read the story of Tucker's Kobolds?
Is that the really old story about the deadly kobolds?
Yes, the Spec Ops kobolds.
Maybe that's a different set of deadly kobolds.
No. I think Jonathan's talking about some classic literature thing. Am I right?
It's not literature. I mean, it's...
What is it?
It's so no. There was one DM, old school DM, who was famous making his high level characters cry with kobolds.
Yes, that's it.
I don't know this.
Yeah, and like to get down to the lower levels, first they would have to fight their way past the kobolds, and the kobolds were always using tricks and secret doors and whatever. And it's just like, you know, you have these high level characters that keep getting humiliated by 3 foot tall scaly critters.
I will send you the article, Rob.
That is a little bit of S&M action. Come on! You know, it's like, oh, you think you're high level adventurers, I'm gonna put you in your place with degradation. All right. Please do send me the article, but don't send me the specially illustrated version. Thank you.
Yeah, one of my great battles back in really, you know, old school, middle school days, and it was kobolds. It was a ton of kobolds pouring out through secret doors and attacking the characters from both sides. And, you know, I mean, whatever, compared to the battles that we run now, it's not that great. But yeah, I've always thought they were cool.
Well, the funny part about it is that because they work for the blue in Drakenhall, there is room for kobolds that just mess you up.
Yeah.
And we, if Jonathan feels like it, I may hit him up for, this is great, guys. Keep talking about this, and I'll be able to get a little more work from Jonathan.
Well, while we're on the topic of the 13th Age Monthly, just wanted to say that the Summoning Spells in the last publication was really good.
Yes.
And you threw some hints in there about some future cleric spells and wizards, elemental summonings, that sort of thing. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to tell us about future publications?
Here's what I can say. I think at first I was taking a bit of a standoffish piece. I mean, I was developing the monthly, but I wasn't heavily involved in creating it. I was being much more like an editor slash developer. But what I am trying to do now is every other month, I'm either writing it or co-designing it with somebody. So there's going to be more player-oriented material, like the summoning spells. And there's going to be an adventure by Cal in the next installment. That ties in, well, sort of, with Robin's Strangling Sea book that should be out around Gen Con. And I'm having a lot of fun with the monthly, and I'm very happy to, like, have gone ahead and said, oh, heck, I'll go ahead and, like, work on every other issue really hard. So there's a bunch of stuff coming from Ash, and we have some new writers coming up. So I think that the one thing we weren't doing for the first few months really was player-oriented stuff, where it's like that nearly everybody playing the game would want to take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what's going to change in the upcoming months. There will be Jonathan has a piece he wrote the first big part of the Seven Icons campaign, and that is going to have a bunch of player stuff in it too, and that'll be a couple months from now.
Yeah, so summoning, I think, is I'm really excited about it. You know, I was the one that put the summoning spells into third edition, and I thought it was, you know, a great way to make more use out of the monsters and give spellcasters sort of more options for how to deal with stuff. I'm not 100% happy with the way it turned out, but what's exciting about summoning in 13th Age is that We're just sort of unashamedly making the rules to make sure that play works right. Whereas a lot of third edition was sort of, well, what would it be like if you summoned a monster? You know, I mean, it was more mechanical and less, there was less concern for how the game actually played. And it's great to be able to keep coming back to summoning and try different ways of doing it.
Yeah, I think what Jonathan is referring to partly is that the versions we did in the 13 True Ways with the Druid and the Necromancer, as you can tell from looking at the Summoning Spells article, we are not doing that way again. The thing about the versions the Druid and the Necromancer have is they can slow the table down a bit because you have the summoned creatures taking their full turns and the summoner taking their full turn. And you know, the result of that was that there's a limit for the Druid and the Necromancer on how many summoning spells they cast. But, you know, if you get a Necromancer who casts one summoning spell and then manages to do that other one that rips the skeletons out of people and turns them into mooks, you know, all of a sudden, and the Necromancer has a skeletal follower, that Necromancer's got a lot of things on the table. So the new mechanics that are in the summoning spell article and that are also being refined in the Glorantha book tend to make it so that there's only going to be one full action on the part of you mm-hmm. or your creature for most summoners. Now, and those rules don't supplant how the Druid and Necromancer do it. They need to stay using the same rules. But what you'll see in the future is that there's an emphasis on not slowing the table down completely because one person is playing multiple characters. There's still a little bit of that, but it's not as much.
Right, and that was the big problem with the third edition summoning, is that you put a whole bunch more monsters in, and now it just takes longer for the summoner to take their turn. So it takes longer for a round of combat to be completed.
Yep. Mark and I are shaking our heads, or nodding affirmatively.
Okay. Yeah.
I like that. Shaking the head. This is a term that English doesn't quite
That's
do.
Right. No, we're up and down. Up and down. Yes.
Shaking vertically.
Right. Well, let's switch gears here and talk a little bit. You have an upcoming book called Shards of the Broken Sky. Can you give us a quick overview? And
actually, I think Shards is going to come out next year.
Oh, really?
This is a book that I did the original outline for. And then Ash took that outline and went crazy, and delivered everything that was in my outline, and then another huge chunk besides. So that book, I don't think it's not as big as Eyes of the Stone Thief, but it is fairly large. And what's going to happen is that before we put out Shards, we're going to be putting out a few smaller books. And then, you know, basically, I don't think we need another giant adventure like Eyes of the Stone Thief right away. And Shards turned into a giant adventure. And, you know, rather than gut it and be like, okay, we're going to cut it all the way down so that it fits the page count requirement, that doesn't seem right. So, because it's just really good and it's really fun. And it's been playtested, and it's going to be totally wacky. But we don't need another giant adventure to publish right now. So we're going to do other books first. Shards will be out sometime next year. And when I say next year, I mean 2016.
Well, what are these other smaller books that you speak of?
Battle Scenes is three of them. So
okay,
three.
Once upon a time, when we started the Battle Scenes project, the idea was to go ahead and create sessions at Adventurer, Champion, and Epic tier that could be plugged into ongoing campaigns that would just involve battles or interesting little mini adventures for each of the 13 icons. So what you end up with is essentially 13 installments at Adventurer, 13 installments at Champion, 13 installments at Epic, and each of those installments is basically like a day or so of adventuring. I was always against splitting the books up. I wanted to have it as one, hey, we need to do this as one book. And then, of course, it was finished, and it was like, oh, well, good Lord. No, it has published anything that size.
That's some book.
I'm looking over at, it's like, oh, how about the Guide to Glorantha? not good. And so I had the wrong idea about how to split them, because in my brain I was always like, oh, I don't really want to split them into the tiers. Well, Simon suggested something smarter, which was splitting them by icon. So there are going to be three Battle Scenes books. One of them you could describe as High Magic and Low Cunning. Another you could describe as all the faith-based icons. Another one is all the royalty, you know. So you'll get
the rulers.
You'll get the Emperor, the Lich King, the Dwarf King, and the Elf Queen, you know, are in that book. And then the one with all the faith-based icons, I don't know, I think the tentative title, I probably shouldn't say it, but what I call when I'm working on it is Your Faith Will Set You on Fire, I think it's something like that. And so what these books then are, you know, if you're playing a campaign and you've got anybody involved with any of those icons, then you can pick this up and use it at any tier. I think the first book is likely to have five of the icons, and the ones of the second and third book are likely to have four icons apiece. And we're getting set to start commissioning the art for it, and I'm finishing development in the first book.
So do you think you're going to release all three at one time, or are you going to stagger them?
No. positive we're going to stagger them. Yep, definitely not going to release them at the same time. There's no payoff if you're like going to go ahead and like make multiple books that are pretty big. I mean, that's the thing. This is not a small book. The first one is actually reasonably close to being as big as Shards. The others are smaller, but the first one, it's so that's the thing. If you put all three of these together, there's, oh God, no. So no, you want to publish them separately because that way it gives people time to digest them, you know?
Yeah.
And, it's more like having, hey, wait, it's more like having a game line.
What?
Instead of a mat. Yeah. You know, honestly, retailers and distributors, they don't want to have you publish all three at the same time.
That's right.
Unless you are publishing the Dungeons and Dragons Player's Handbook, Monster Manual, and DMG, they would rather you staggered it. And honestly, you know, they even want those staggered because they have to spend so much money, for instance, on buying those that they want to have them come in different months.
So they want people to come into the store over and over again.
So whenever you're doing something like this, go ahead and don't try to put it all out in one big chunk. If you're splitting it up already, keep it split up.
Yeah.
Okay.
So are you thinking 2016 for the first book as well, or are you thinking further out than that?
It might be sooner than that. No, the first battle scenes text is pretty much done. I'm just working on final development on it, which is to say cleaning up word choice in places and changing a couple NPC motivations and adding a couple new abilities to monsters. You know, that for the first book, that's what I'm doing, and then we got to do the art. So the art, it's possible it could be the end of this year, and if it's not, it'll be very early the next year.
That'd be great.
Very cool. Well, let's get to what I'm really excited to talk about then, which is 13th Age Glorantha.
Yeah.
How is that coming?
Fun.
So, you know, this is a game world that Rob and I were both involved in, you know, years and years ago. It was the first game world that convinced me that a published game world would be worth paying attention to. Because until RuneQuest and Glorantha, I always made my own worlds. And this is a world that I've been thinking about for 30 years. And now, you know, we're finally putting it sort of into our terms. That's pretty exciting.
It's a very interesting project because, I mean, it's got the sort of the biggest, I think, combined quotient of love for the project and actually somewhat difficult things to figure out.
You know, yeah.
I don't know if I've been involved in a project that had that combined, you know, the sum total of those two things were as big. So, yeah, it's fascinating, interesting. I'm actually, like, what I'm doing last night and this morning is going through my notebooks that I've been writing in for the last couple years about this project and finding all the pieces that are worthwhile and bringing them out. And I'm designing the Earth Priestess class right now, and it's one of those fun things where I think that in a certain sense she'll do a couple things that other classes have never done before, which is fun. But to make things interesting on that level, as an example of how 13th Age going into Glorantha sort of shifts the picture for Glorantha, HeroQuest used adventuring priestesses because HeroQuest system is so storytelling narrative oriented that the magical power that you can have there, you know, it works out. But there's been no crunchy role playing game, you know, like RuneQuest. Yeah. I don't, you know, in RuneQuest, it wasn't that common to go ahead and have a, you know, an Earth Priestess like adventuring with the party, making things happen because the mechanics just didn't support it.
Right. There were rules. You could be an alchemist or you could be a pacifist Earth Priestess or whatever. It's just, it wasn't fun to play. Like, if you had a party of adventurers and then
you were all that.
Right? Yeah.
If they were all that, you were dead.
Yeah. So it was, RuneQuest was interesting in that it mechanically it let you play all sorts of weird characters, but like at the table when those characters would try to have an adventure together, it was difficult to make that fly. And so, you know, we take very seriously the experience that you have at the table. We're not just going to stat up a class and say, well, this is what its abilities would be, and you find out whether it's fun or you figure out how to have fun. Like we are always trying to make sure that everything first and foremost is something that people are going to want to play at the table.
Well, not only want to play, but also have good effects on the game. Because, for instance, it's like actually
that's right.
People want to play a Chelana Aroy healer.
Right.
And here, this is something I don't think I've talked about in detail. I actually went ahead and designed one using some philosophy that I thought was using philosophy that actually made it more fun to play. But on the other hand, its impact on the table was not good. Not good. Its impact on the game, not good. You know, just, it was sort of so bad, in fact, that it was like, yeah, you know, some people want this, but we don't want to design this version of 13th Age around this being part of the environmental dynamic of the game. We're just not going to do it. And so the Earth Priestess is a class that is much more active. It has some ability to, like, be helping its allies, but,
yeah, the big problem with the Chelana Aroy character is that traditionally their shtick is that they are pacifists and they might want to subdue or neutralize opponents, but they're not going to kill them. And it's hard for that. I mean, in RuneQuest, that was difficult. And in 13th Age, it would be the same, where if three of the people at the table are trying to kill things and one person is trying not to kill them, I mean, it's really hard for them to all have fun together.
Well, actually, it also turned out another dynamic that Jonathan really helped me work through, and that is that we are doing this version of Glorantha with just less healing magic for the player characters.
Yes.
We're balancing things for Glorantha so that you're not counting on that other character to cast a healing spell or feed you a healing potion. And the game is balanced so that there is no dedicated healer, and we don't want to... So throwing a dedicated healer into that mix doesn't actually help us. So,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, makes sense. Mark and I were exchanging glances. I tried to play a pacifist in a Shadowrun game and made it exactly two sessions and then made a sniper.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, I guess if it was Marvel Comics, your pacifist would have had something terrible happen to them and then would have become a sniper.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. I've had people try to play pacifist, and it's just, they seem to have fun, but everyone else at the table is kind of like, really, dude? I mean,
yeah.
We're here to slay kobolds.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's one of the great things that, you know, third edition did, and I think the other editions that followed it, is get people so that they all want to do the same thing, right? Second edition had come up with rules for different characters getting experience points for different kinds of things, and so, you know, every character would want to do something different, and it seemed like a good idea. I know role players who thought it was cool, but the effect on the table was you couldn't all get together and have fun doing the same thing.
Right.
And that's like, we're all getting together around the table so that we can all get together and have fun doing the same thing. The assassin character that likes to kill other people, or the thief that steals from other people in the party, and all those things, just like you said, the player often has a lot of fun playing that character, but it's at the expense of the experience at the table.
Yeah. So for so long, Glorantha has existed before the Hero Wars. How is it to be working within the time frame of the Hero Wars?
So it's a pretty big challenge, but it opens up a lot of opportunities. The challenge is, with 13th Age, we set the icons in balance, in a sort of a dynamic balance, so that the world isn't static, but there is no one big thing happening that everyone has to pay attention to. You can go all around and have all sorts of different kinds of adventures. With the Hero Wars, you know, this is a climactic battle with great heroes and gods and, reality being torn and what have you. It's hard to ignore. Like, you have to be involved in, to one degree or another what's going on, but the way we're playing it is that reality is being ripped apart by all these conflicts, and so there's just crazy stuff happening everywhere, and that frees you up. Like now you don't have to worry about economics or farming or politics and all the stuff that often sort of, if you're trying to simulate a sophisticated world, there's all these layers to the society and whatever. If you're in a world where that society has fallen apart because there have been these huge wars and catastrophes or what have you, now you have more freedom to for the GM to invent what they want and for players to invent what they want, because there's no stable society that they refer to.
I think what you'll see is that the future playtest packets, and definitely the final, that will have a stronger presentation of this this unraveling state, and that's kind of going to be the default setting for 13th Age of Garantha, because we know that there's a lot of people playing the game who don't know Glorantha well, and it is so much easier for it's such a clearer story for those people to be dealing with like the unraveling world and necessary heroics. Now, if you're a longtime Glorantha fan, you're not going to have any problem going ahead and like using the system to go ahead and play out things that are more established in the canon, either before the Hero Wars or just taking a different slant on it with your own campaign. But I would say that like our current playtest packets haven't presented the unraveling as strongly as they're going to in the future. We're sort of getting things set on a baseline at the moment. For ourselves mechanically, and then we're going to like be handling that in the final write-up. And one way to look at that, I think what Jonathan said is, 13th Age, the icons are in dynamic balance, and everybody's like, oh no, the portents are bad,
Right.
But what's happening with the Hero Wars here is, well, Orlanth was dead, Arnaldo was dead, getting them back tore giant holes in the world, and now it is...
It's not just portents that are bad.
It's not just portents. The myths you used to know are trying to kill you. Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, and so 13th Age is sort of lets you, imagine that the campaign could come to a smashing conclusion with the end of the 13th Age. And with the Hero Wars, that looks like the Third Age has already ended, right? Yeah. You are in that climactic end of an age already.
Very cool.
Yeah, really cool.
Well, one of the nice things of having an exclusive interview with you guys is being able to ask you if you want to share any insider information. So I was just curious, what can you tell us about 13th Age and Glorantha that hasn't already been talked about publicly?
Here's a insider secret that we haven't talked about. Really, the Lunars are the good guys. They're sophisticated. They're open-minded. We are all us.
That's right.
And
they've got that awesome moon.
13th Age of Glorantha is set up so that you'll start out in the unenlightened state as a barbarian, and you'll experience the world that way. But if you play it right, or if you buy the next supplement, you'll see that really the Lunars are the good guys in all of this. That's the secret. It's not that, and we're not going to spell that out in this book.
No.
You heard it here first, folks. Lunars are the good guys in 13th Age Glorantha.
In fact, you may never actually see it in print. It'll just be one of those secrets.
But those who have ears to hear,
let them hear.
Thank you for the message.
Well, you guys just mentioned it, and I know when we talked with Jeff last, he mentioned that there were plans for other books in the 13th Age Glorantha line.
Did Jeff tell you what they were?
He did not. I was hoping you might know.
Oh, Jeff did not tell you what they were. Well, I hate to say this, but that is a Jeff thing to tell you.
All right.
Is not me. It is not us.
I mean, I mentioned maybe a new book or whatever,
right.
Honestly, we don't have any plans. I would love
to do. No, there are plans. You just don't know.
I don't know the plans. I would love to do a Lunar book because I always played RuneQuest with the Lunars as the bad guys, and they are the best bad guys because maybe they're the good guys.
Yeah.
And so this has been a great experience for me, and I know for Rob, like coming back to Glorantha after all this, after loving it for decades and putting our own spin on it and like jazzing it up so that it's more exciting and more stuff can happen and bringing in things like the one unique thing to really let people sink their teeth into the setting, that's really exciting. And man, if we could do a Lunar book, I don't know, I would be jazzed.
It would be another interesting thought. I mean, it would be another challenge in terms
it would be
of
a,
it would be a very
it would also be a really
challenge.
Difficult. Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
And then there are, I mean, I can just offhandedly even admit that it would be a case where I'm not even positive that like deep things like, you know, the root, like the runes might not even work the same. You know, the runes don't even work the same. It's like you're a lunar now.
Yeah.
Blah, different. Wow. So I know that there's another book that's either being worked on or will be being worked on soon. But I'm pretty sure that book is waiting for us to finish this.
Okay.
And so I also feel like that's Jeff's
place.
That's Jeff's place to talk
yeah.
about it.
No, that's fair.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, any other final questions, gentlemen?
Yeah, earlier you mentioned two words that reminded me that you guys are working on a GM screen. Is that right?
You know, Cal Moore and Wade Rocket are working on the GM screen. And I'm helping out by talking with the artists. So it is underway. And the plan is that it will also have a booklet for GMs in it. So there's your insider information.
There we go.
Yeah. So that's the current plan right now. And I should say that, you know, it's possible that like something may change that. But in terms of the GM screen, actually people working on it right this moment, yes.
Excellent.
It's happening. Yep. And I would expect, I mean, I don't know. I would expect that to be out before the first Battle Scenes book.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, we'll keep an eye out for it.
Would be my guess. Yep.
Now, Rob, I know you're also working on Iconic Organizations. Do you want to share a few words with that?
I started referring to it as, a word that probably doesn't work, but icon followers, partially because I want it to be not just the organizations that are involved with the icons, but also just, you know, people and other, you know, just into it doesn't have to be a full organization. If it's somebody really, really interesting, it's an NPC monster that's involved with the icon.
Yeah, associates.
I think what you should expect is that when a book of that ilk hits the stands, it will have the same five icons as the first Battle Scenes book.
Ingenious.
So that when somebody at a convention or a game store is like, "Ooh, I like this," they point to one of them.
Yeah.
The person behind the counter with the game store says, "Well, okay, that's awesome, and you know, you might want this too because it had blah blah." Yeah, and you know, reality is it's sort of going to be like it's going to be a bestiary for NPCs. Hmm. Partially, it's interesting variations on the icons because you want to go ahead and do something. You know, if you're doing the Archmage, everybody knows that the Archmage is probably served by a whole bunch of wizards. So, okay, here's a couple wizard stats. But you don't want to just spend time doing only that, you know? So, for example, one of the organizations that Ash created is a group of escaped or freed familiars.
Yep, I love
so
it.
That you get a whole... And that, okay, but and they're involved with the Archmage, you know, clearly, but they might have a bit of a conflicting relationship with the man. and then what you get is you get a style of NPC that sort of bestiary, let's call it bestiary style. It's trying to inspire game masters to come up with their own riffs on this thing, and it's not precisely what you'd expect from the material, but it's something that's obviously involved with this icon and always has. It just hasn't been completely fleshed out before. So that's sort of the goals of the project. It also obviously has to like handle. I mean, the truth is, we only did one or two human monsters in the core book, and there are people who want to know, well, if I was going to have somebody who was like a wizard or a ranger, you know, what interesting mechanic would you go ahead and suggest? And obviously, you don't want NPCs with giant spell books. You know, you don't want to treat them the same as player characters. And you know, you've seen other examples of this in Shadows of Eldaland, where there are wizards from a school and stuff like that. But the challenge is to show people how interesting NPCs can be handled just like monsters in ways that are both playable and inspiring. So that book is not as far along. It's definitely long after the battle scenes book.
Okay. Mark's waving his money at you.
I totally see familiars being the spies for the Archmage. They work for him.
Oh,
so he can
yeah.
keep an eye on wizards so they don't get too uppity.
That's right.
That's right. Well, or, you know, boy, that was just a really negative. Yes.
I love it.
So one of the funny things also, okay, here's another example of the things those books will probably have. You know, it could have a view of the Elf Queen as a warrior queen. You know, what you saw was her at the court. What does it look like when she goes to the battlefield? Well, it doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
You know, so, and, or, I, you know, if there's one commonality, have you noticed this, Jonathan? Somebody else was mentioning this to me the other day, and I was like, yeah, you're right. I think it could have been Ash who was mentioning it. He basically said, the Emperor is always a douchebag. It's like
that's a given.
Well, it's the picture. It's the picture. It's like Lee did that picture deliberately. Like I'm in my goblet. I got my goblet on my throne with my sword, and I do not have a smile on my face. You know, you are a jerk, sir. You know, if that guy was in our world, Will. He'd have a really nasty beard, drive a Camaro. Oh, come on! Don't pick up Camaro drivers. He'd be on Wall Street. You know, the Wolf of Wall. So I think that the thing is that it's possible that even by showing slightly, we haven't shown other Art of the Icons, and we may show some other takes on them that will then inform different styles of campaign or different uses of them. Perhaps I shouldn't make a point of trying to make the Emperor not a douchebag. It's just too useful for people. If he isn't, someone else has to be. So perhaps best. Yeah. So that is what's going on with that. Thank you guys for having a great podcast.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, the one thing I want to leave with, I want to make sure that 13th Age fans know that the Glorantha book is for them. Like, even if you don't play in Glorantha, it's, chock full of new classes, new treasures, new monsters. And, Glorantha has sort of a fresh take on fantasy, more mythic-oriented and what have you. And so... I think it'll be an interesting source book even for people that want to keep playing in the Dragon Empire or wherever their home campaign is set.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be able to do as much in the book to say, here's how to use it in the Dragon Empire. There'll be a few sidebars.
Yeah.
But the fact is that even hero questing, you know, the giant,
right.
can easily be used as an adventuring framework inside regular Dragon Empire games. Just has a different attitude towards the legends of previous icons, you know, and their activities. And I don't have precise plans for how much. I know that once it's published at Pelgrane, Simon and Kat are going to be very happy about having things written that show how to like use the 13th Age of Glorantha book in Dragon Empire games, and vice versa, because there's, you know, a big chunk of our monster chapter in 13th Age of Glorantha, for example, is talking about, oh, you want to use giants?
Yeah.
You want to use gnolls? Well, here's how you use them. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Awesome. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for taking time out and jumping on the show.
Yep. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.